You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Marlis Paterson and conductor Sir Andrew Davis are backstage at Lyric.
There are some really magic moments, and I think also the spoken moments is one of those magic things. You know, it's like a melody underneath, only in the orchestra, and you have the feeling that the sky opens up.
And it is very Mahlerian, I think you could say. I mean, there always was a big influence of Mahler in Berg's music from the three orchestral pieces onward. And it has this very slow, sustained adagio with slightly tortured kind of harmonies, but very beautiful and beautifully scored.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. We'll be playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for Alban Berg's Lulu. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening performance. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We include all the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Marlis Paterson and Sir Andrew Davis. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I am delighted to welcome to the Discovery Series the leading lady and the conductor of our extraordinary new production of Berg's Lulu, which opens tomorrow night. Now, all of us at Lyric Opera are thrilled that the German soprano Marlis Paterson is returning to us to star as Lulu. She is internationally acknowledged as today's foremost interpreter of this exceptionally demanding role, which she has performed most recently in Athens. Previously, she triumphed with it in Vienna, Hamburg, Kassel, Düsseldorf, and in her role debut in Nuremberg. She is a celebrated exponent of comic repertoire as well. Adele in Die Fledermaus was the vehicle of her sensational debuts at Lyric and at the Met. And Serbinetta in Ariadne auf Naxos was a great success for her at Covent Garden and in Monte Carlo. She is closely associated with Düsseldorf's Deutsche Oper am Rhein, and she has starred at the major houses of Dresden, Paris, Munich, and Geneva, as well as the Salzburg, Bregenz, and Aix-en-Provence festivals. You can see her on DVD as Elisa in the Salzburg production of Mozart's Il Re Pastore. I want to let you know also that I will be speaking with Marlis about her life and career as part of the Sing Out series, that is the collaboration between Lyric Opera and the Center on Halsted, on Monday evening, November 17th at the Center. And you can get the details of that event at the Center's website, which is centeronhalsted.org. Our music director, Sir Andrew Davis, enjoyed a triumph with Lulu during his tenure as music director of Glyndebourne Festival Opera, and that production is available on DVD. In addition to Lulu, he is leading this season's Madame Butterfly, Tristan und Isolde, and Abduction from Seraglio at Lyric. At La Scala, where he conducted The Cunning Little Vixen just a few seasons ago, he will be back this spring to conduct a new production of Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream. Later this season, he will be leading concerts with the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, the Munich Philharmonic, and Royal Philharmonic, among others. Sir Andrew's recording of the Elgar Violin Concerto with James Ennis just received one of the most prestigious awards in the classical recording field, the Gramophone Award. So please join me in welcoming to the Discovery Series Sir Andrew Davis and Marlis Paterson. Before we begin, I need to give you a brief synopsis because this is an opera that, after all, we have not done here in two decades. Before the opera begins, you should know that in her early teens, Lulu was found on the street and taken in by Dr. Shun, who is a respected newspaper editor, and he gives her the wherewithal to have a decent life. He eventually has an affair with her, but he chooses to marry her off to an old doctor. Well, when the doctor finds Lulu and a painter who is doing her portrait making love, he collapses and dies. Well, the painter marries Lulu, but she continues her liaison with Dr. Shun. Well, he gets engaged to a young woman from a respectable family, and he now tells Lulu that he wants her out of his life, but she is unwilling to give him up. Well, Shun tells the painter of his affair with Lulu, and the distraught painter kills himself.
What's funny about that?
At Lulu's insistence, Shun writes a letter breaking off his engagement. He marries Lulu, although she continues to receive many admirers, including Countess Geschwitz and Schön's own son, Alva. Well, Lulu's behavior so enrages Schön that he eventually gives her a revolver and orders her to shoot herself. But alas, she kills him. Ain't no laughing matter, believe me. Although she instantly declares that he was the only man she ever loved. Alva is distraught, but at the same time, his feelings for Lulu are too strong to resist. So that she can escape the police, she runs away to Paris with him, but circumstances then force her to flee once again, and she winds up in London, supporting Alva in a poverty-stricken existence. She actually is working as a streetwalker. Well, Alva and one of her hangers-on, an old man who may or may not be her father, Shigoch, she is supporting both of them, essentially. On her first night as a streetwalker, she brings home a client who kills Alva, and another client, Jack the Ripper, kills Lulu. So Countess Geschwitz, who's just arrived from Paris, is killed by Jack as well, and she dies declaring that she will be with her beloved Lulu forever. Okay.
I've never heard that in such a short...
Absolutely.
I was in
a cab not long ago, and a cab driver, we got talking about it, and he said, well, can you tell me the story? Fortunately, it was about a 20-minute cab ride, and it took me the whole time.
So the first question for both of you, actually, is, has performing this piece fulfilled any kind of professional ambition for you, or was it a piece that came to you almost by chance?
For me, it came really by chance, because I was just 2 years in my first engagement in Nuremberg, and it wasn't planned, it wasn't on the schedule, and the musical director at that time decided to put it on.
For you?
No.
Oh, really?
That's the funny thing. I think we were three sopranos from the same kind of voice, and I think he thought none of us would make the whole opera because we're very young and inexperienced. So he split us three. First act, one soprano. Second act, second soprano. Third act.
Which act did you get?
I did the first one. And they dressed us up all exactly the same. So you couldn't, in the third act, when the lovers come back as somebody else, the Lulu of the act joined him for that. Nobody realized who it was. So it was really, for me, it was just by chance. But when I, of course, did it at that time, I was sure that I need to do the whole piece. That was immediately clear after 4 weeks.
And how long did it take for you to do the whole thing?
3 years later? Two years later. Yeah.
And so this is your seventh production?
Yeah.
Seventh production.
Yeah.
Wow. Andrew, had you always wanted to do it?
Yes, absolutely. I was, during my teens, I lived just outside London. I used to go up on the train every Saturday to have lessons, piano, and play the oboe rather badly. We won't go into that. And we had sort of history and ear training classes with a man who was probably in his mid-20s at the time, a very interesting chap who was doing a lot of contemporary music. This is in the sort of late 50s, early 60s. And he introduced me actually to Stravinsky, first of all, and because I didn't know any really 20th century music at all, and I instantly fell in love with Stravinsky and still consider him one of the gods of music. But I went home, actually, one Saturday afternoon after one of these classes and thought, I'm going to go into my local record store and buy a piece of 20th century music by some composer I'd never heard of. So I did exactly that, and I ended up buying a 10-inch LP, do you remember those, of the Berg Violin Concerto. I never heard of Alban Berg, and I went home, put it on, and was completely knocked out by it. I was about 14. And then I became absolutely fascinated with Berg, and I listened to every Berg piece that I possibly could, and eventually got to Lulu. Well, and then I started reading books about Berg, and I was intrigued, first of all, by the opera. And so I started to study it, probably when I was about 19 or something. And actually, I went to study in Italy for a year after being at Cambridge University. And I studied with this marvelous conducting teacher, great man called Franco Ferrara. When I didn't know when I went there that he didn't like any music written really after Puccini very much. So, you know, the first opera we studied was Il Barbiere di Siviglia. And then he said, there were about six of us in the class, and he said to us all, which opera would you like to study next? And I said, Lulu. And there was this stunned silence from my co-students. And he said, I think you should work on Don Carlo. So that's what I did. But all my time in Italy, every spare minute when I wasn't studying what I was supposed to for him, I was working on Lulu. And so, but it wasn't, I think, until 93 or 94, many years later, that I finally conducted it for the first time. I did a concert performance of it with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, of which I was music director, in the Royal Festival Hall. Wonderful cast, including... did you meet Patricia Wise the other day?
Yes, I did.
Pat Wise was a coloratura soprano, American, who is now teaching Bloomington, Indiana. And she came to the performance, and we hadn't seen each other since we did that performance all those years ago. And then I subsequently conducted at Glyndebourne when I was music director there. So this is only my third time compared to seven here, but it's a piece I've known and loved all my life. And as those of you who've seen my podcast on the website know, that I do love this opera so very much that I named my dog after it.
Highly recommended. You must all go to our website and listen to everything that Sir Andrew has to say on the subject of Lulu. It's extremely enlightening. Do that before you go to the performance. Well, Marlis, how did you know that your instrument was right for this role, which is one of the most exceptionally challenging in the entire repertoire for in any vocal category?
You know, when I encountered it the first time, I didn't know anything. So I just learned it, and then I found out that I can do it. Just the first act. And before I did the whole piece once, 2 years later, I took also my score to France and started to look into the second and third act, and I just tried out what is going, what is not going, and I found out that it's a demanding piece for the voice, but if you do it in a Mozartarian way, as Berg intended it in one of his essays, he wrote that he imagined himself a lyric light soprano for the piece, and I found out that this works out fantastic for me. And so
you
did.
So you approached it no differently than you would approach any other role.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been looking at the score a lot lately, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I could imagine sopranos maybe learning one bar of it a day, because it was, which means it would take you like 5 years to learn the whole thing. But
at that time, we had a very, very modern musical director in Nuremberg, and we did a lot of contemporary music, so I was already into the whole modern things, contemporary, and he recommended me to read all these secondary books, so how do you call them, you know, where you can read about how it is composed, the whole 12-tone thing, and I did that, and that helped a lot, actually, to do the right approach to it.
Was there anything that you had sung before that prepared you where you said, because I did thus and such, I know that I can do this?
You know, my first piece ever on stage was The Fiery Angel of
Prokofiev. Oh my gosh.
So that's not really an operetta to start my career. But yeah, I think it came by chance that I was thrown into all these pieces.
20th century, yes.
And maybe it helped because I learned the piano when I was 7, and I knew I played Bartok and Hindemith and all that. So I had no barrier for this music. And this was very easy. And as I didn't study singing at first, but to be a teacher in the school, so I had to do all the theoretical parts also. So this was easy for me to do it.
Well, how important, I mean, you were talking about the 12 tone idea before. How important was that, and how did it help you in your study?
To know about 12 tone?
Yes.
Actually, I think I was talking to Nathalie Dessay the last week, because she loves this piece very much and she wants to do it. But she said, I can't imagine how you learn this. And I said to her, I actually told her that it helps a lot when you know how Berg has created the lines for every person. And when you know your own line and all the... How is that? Krebs, Umkehrung, and all these different things. I don't know how they are in
yes,
English.
Yes, well, inversions and retrograde versions.
Yeah.
So it's...
This is the mathematical idea. He has a basic line, which he uses in this way or on another tone,
yeah.
Or backwards, or...
Upside down.
So this is how...
Or upside down and backwards.
Yeah. This is the whole idea of this construction. And so every person has a certain line. And if you know your line and all the alterations and you can sing it, so you know the whole piece. It's very easy.
So Andrew, then, does he use tone rows the way that Wagner uses leitmotifs?
Well, for those of you who don't really know about the 12-note system, which was invented by Schoenberg, Berg's teacher, it's basically the idea that you destroy... It's a sort of substituting for the major and minor scales. Well, this is oversimplifying, but this series of notes... So you use all the 12 notes of the chromatic scale from one octave... in the space of an octave, in a specified order that you determine, and then that is the and you can't repeat one note before all 12 have been sung. Now that's of course very much oversimplified, and Berg actually used this system, but used it very freely and used it in a way that's often very tonal. So there's a lot of conventional harmony in Berg. There's even a C major chord at one point. When Schigolch, the old man who we think might be her father, is asking her for money. And interestingly enough, there's a C major chord in Berg's other opera, Wozzeck, which is also when Marie and Wozzeck are talking about money.
Yeah.
Which is a sort of... which slightly reminds me of the story about... Sorry, this is going completely off the tangent. When Schoenberg met George Gershwin, they lived in Los Angeles, and they used to play tennis together, I think. Anyway, Gershwin asked him if he could have lessons from Schoenberg. And Schoenberg said to me, how much money did you make last year? And Gershwin told him, he said, I would like lessons with you. But what Berg does, and it's I mean, intellectually, the sort of compositional apparatus, if you like, of this opera is extraordinarily complex and very, very clever, but it doesn't matter. And for example, there is one note row, series or whatever you call it, that is the principal one for the whole opera, from which the others are all derived. And this sounds very technical, but it really isn't.
Can you sing
one of the things that he does is he takes the first three notes, second three notes, third three notes, fourth three notes, and makes a sequence of four chords, which are associated with Lulu's portrait. And from that, he makes a melodic line, which then consists of the top notes, the middle notes, and the bottom notes. And this goes... ra da da dee dee da ra dee ra ra dee dum. which is very, you know, you think, oh, well, that sounds all right. And so there's this melody that is constantly associated with Ludwig's. Now, it's a very singable tune, you must admit, which is one thing you say. So people said to me over the years, but can you hum a tune from Lulu? And I said, oh, there are lots of them. But the other thing about that tune, for instance, is that you put it upside down, instead of going da da dee da dee da 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 da, it goes da 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 da.
Now everybody.
But the thing is, it's very easy to see that one is the upside down version of the other. Now, when you start going backwards, that's another thing, because it's very difficult to hear that. not to mention backwards and upside down. But and then, you know, each of the characters has his own note row, but they also have very strong melodic characteristics, so that each character is extremely well defined by his musical compositional equipment, if you like. So yes, so these melodic and harmonic ideas are very much used in the leitmotif way by Berg. That was a very long answer to a very simple question.
There are so many different ways that a line of text can be delivered in this piece. It's actually listed in the score. I wanted to ask you both about this. Lines that are completely sung, purely sung, that are half sung, that are spoken in free prose with no accompaniment at all, which are spoken in free prose with accompaniment, that are spoken in rhythms that are specifically notated in the score, and that are spoken in high, middle, and low ranges that are indicated note by note in the score. So what do you think, each of you, what do each of you think Berg's dramatic justification is for having lines delivered in all of these different ways? Marlis, when you're speaking a particular passage, and you do have several in the course of the role, why do you think speaking is the most effective way to deliver those lines, as opposed to purely singing them or doing one of these other methods?
I only can speak for what I feel about this. I think that when we talk, each of us, it's something very personal to somebody. And I think all the spoken lines are very much, they have a strong expression and a very important message to give to the other person or to the audience. For me, it's like, it's hard to explain that. Can you help me with that?
Well, yes. Absolutely. There's a very good example of this. I mean, sometimes there's dialogue that's completely unaccompanied by the orchestra. The orchestra's silent. But now there are certain places. There's in the first scene where she's Lulu and Dr. Schoen are having an argument, and it comes to this sort of climactic point, and all of a sudden the singing stops. The orchestra plays this very slow music, which plays a very important role. Is Dr. Schoen music, and Lulu goes into dialogue and says to him, and this is the first time we hear this kind of her feelings for him, when she says, "If there's any man that I
in the world
that I
me.
Cared for, it's you, and you took me from the streets when I was trying to steal your watch." That's a wonderful line.
Yeah,
and this is spoken. And the effectiveness of this is absolutely extraordinary. It's like Lulu sort of breaks
up a
barrier down, and the simplest and the way she needs to deliver it is in speech. So I think that's one of the things. Frankly, these very fine gradations are very difficult to achieve. Most people it's easy to, you know, you can sing, you can speak. To make that grade in the middle, when you're half speaking, half singing, which again was an invention of Schoenberg called Sprechgesang, speech song. Marlis does it fantastically, I have to say. But the degree to which you sing and the degree to which you speak is difficult sometimes
it's a
technique that you have to study, don't you think, a little bit, that sort of half song.
Yeah, you have to find out for yourself how to do it. in a way.
And then the question is how important the pitches are, because when you start sort of half singing, then the pitch tends to go. And this again was something that was invented by Schoenberg, the great Schoenberg's teacher. There's a famous piece he wrote called Pierre Lunaire, which is for speaking voice and small ensemble. And the whole thing is in Sprechgesang. But the pitches are all very clearly notated. But there's an old recording. I can't remember who the artist was now, which was Schoenberg's favourite performance of the piece. Apparently, and none of the pictures are anywhere near the ones that are written in the score. So,
I think it's very important that we make clear to the audience here tonight, and to people who will be listening to this conversation as a podcast, that we make clear to everyone what a beautiful piece this is. So can you talk about the particular portions of the score that you love most in terms of sheer beauty, so people will be knowing to anticipate those passages when they hear the complete performance?
It's not easy to pick out things in all this 4-hour, because there are no tunes. There are some really magic moments, and I think also the spoken moments, which are you talking about, mm-hmm. is one of those magic things. You know, it's like there's a melody underneath, only in the orchestra, and you have the feeling that the sky opens up, like yesterday, maybe. And there are some of those moments, and I think it's mostly when this Schönmotiv is there, because it really hits you into the heart, and you lean back and you think, whoa, it's amazing, really.
The first time we hear the slow music in its sort of entirety is a big interlude, second interlude in the first act. And it is very Marlerian, I think you could say. I mean, there always was a big influence of Mahler in Berg's music from the three orchestral pieces onward. And it has this, it's very slow, sustained adagio with slightly tortured kind of harmonies, but very beautiful and beautifully scored. And the extraordinary thing is that this music comes back in the last scene when Lulu brings in to this London attic her last client, who is Jack the Ripper, who is played by the same singer who sings Dr. Schoen. Then this is another very clever thing that Berg does, that the three men who have died in the first half of the opera return as her three customers. And as so there's this sense of retribution, I suppose, or something. This whole beautiful, beautiful music is playing in the orchestra with great intensity at the moment when Jack the Ripper and Lulu are discussing money for the price of the service. And it's a very banal conversation. And she, you know, she says, he says, how much do you want? She says, how much have you got? And he says, well, I've got this, but I need, you know, I need some money
for
my bus fare. And so that, and she ends up saying, oh, forget it anyway.
Yeah,
so
take the money.
And there's something. I mean, this may sound crazy, but the idea that this incredibly banal, sordid conversation is going on with the music underneath that represents Dr. Schoen. I mean, and this is something that you don't have to necessarily have figured this out when you're listening to it in the audience, but the psychology of this is what makes the piece so incredibly powerful, I think. The play there is based on two plays by Wedekind, Earth Spirit and Pandora's Box, which are brilliant plays, but they're very brittle in a way. They're very cynical a lot of the time. What Berg does with Lulu is he takes this brilliant two plays and makes them into an opera that and transforms the whole thing, so that you experience emotions on a level. And this passage I'm talking about is a case in point. And I have to say, when this scene begins, I mean, I know the piece and I've loved the piece for many years. When I'm in the theatre, I can't do it when I'm conducting because you have to keep your upper lip stiff. But when I'm in the theatre watching the thing, this scene starts and the show music starts and this frightening scene takes place. And you'll see, those who come to see the production, I'm sure you're all coming. You better. Schoen, Jack the Ripper's appearance is truly frightening in this production. Just because he is such a dangerous presence when he comes onto the stage. At this point, I always start to weep every time. It's because there's something so profoundly moving about the fact that this fantastic woman, who in a way, although all this terrible stuff happens around her, retains a certain purity of spirit. I don't know what it is. I mean, so in a way, Berg said that Lulu was the sort of female equivalent of Don Juan. But also this wonderful simile that Karl Kraus, who was a famous Viennese director, said about a production that Berg saw when he was very young, about 18, 19 years old in Vienna. He said that Lulu is like the candle flame to which the moths are drawn. So there's a kind of pure spirit, as a flame is a pure spirit. And the men, of course, are attracted to her and are all consumed by this flame. But in a way, there's a kind of, despite all the things that happen to her, there's a kind of innocence about her, at the core of her being.
What brings us into the middle of the whole discussion about Lulu? I don't think you have a lot of questions for that, too.
I wanted, Marlis, if you could describe one particular musical moment, which to me it's the most beautiful thing in the entire role, but it's also as beautiful as anything you'll find for a high soprano to sing in the entire repertoire. That is when she has come back from prison and she feels, well, you know the moment I mean. Okay, could you describe what's going on and what that and how Berg chooses to treat that beautiful line she gets to sing?
I think it's the line in the piece. It says, O Freiheit, what means O freedom. And I mean, she comes back after so many experiences, bad ones, death, men, cholera, then the murder of Dr. Schoen, and she's hunted by police, and she spends this 2 years, I think about more or less 2 years, in this jail. And I think, you know, after, for me, the lead of the Lulu is the first moment of her that she expresses herself. I think she never did that before. She was just acting and reacting and kind of floating through life. But when it comes to this certain moment when Schoen threatens her with her and she shoots him, she starts to, I think back. And I think when she's in the jail, she's growing, maturing in her own way. And when she comes out of this cell, back into the sunlight, back with humans, I think she's in very big need of love in this moment. Not the sexual one, but just the hug one, a person next to her that holds. And so she's back in her old surroundings. And it's just, I know you must know these moments in your life when things happen that you didn't expect, or you meet moments again in your life that you had years before and they were kind of the nicest moments you had ever. This is really like you have a pain in your heart. And I really like how Kevin Knight, our designer, and Paul, how they did this moment. Because the curtain opens up and the sunlight comes in and shines her onto the face. And it's really like...
And what is happening, though, musically? Because the music is so sublime at that point.
First of all, I mean, you've had this... The whole of the opening of this scene, which is the second half of the second act, the whole orchestra is muted. The strings are playing with mute, so there's this kind of dust cloth over the music, as there is over the furniture. And Lulu comes in looking very frail, and then as this moment comes when finally one of the characters, well, she's left alone with Alva, and all of a sudden, the music before it is supposed to have been moving in slow motion. It's like everyone's in a dream world. And then she comes out with this phrase, "O Freiheit," which goes up to a B natural. And it's a glorious note. You should hear the way she sings it. But underneath, the orchestra all of a sudden sounds like Strauss or Puccini put together.
Yeah.
And the idea, I mean, again, you can imagine if in the play she says, well, the line is, "O Freiheit, Herr Gott im Himmel," right?
Mm.
"Oh, freedom, dear God in heaven." Okay, that's a line. But this is what music and opera is all about. This moment really typifies that, exemplifies that in the most incredible way, because all of a sudden, out of this kind of misty, kind of shabby world that we've been going through, is this world of passion. And as you say, it's a moment really of great revelation.
Yeah.
And when all of a sudden life comes back, and you're right, the image of the sunlight flooding into the room is a perfect... I should say a brief word. Well, do you want us to talk about the production at some point? Because it's a fantastic production. And I'd like, actually, Marlis, I'd like Marlis to say something about this, because you've done 7 productions, and you said this was the only production that you've done that wasn't in, like, contemporary setting?
Yeah.
I mean, really modern, up-to-date setting?
Yes. It was, I mean, can we say it plays in the 1930s? And I find the... Die Spaltung. I find the story so much more intense, and the die Spannung,
the tension
enormously more than when you have, anyway, you have modern people, you have modern dressing, you have modern moments. But when you have the old moments, you have 1930s, you have the costumes of that time, you have the furniture of the time. As soon as you put on the clothes, you feel in this time. With hats and gloves and you know, die Fallhöhe is so anders. Is there a word for it?
The what?
Die Fallhöhe.
I don't know.
You know, the rise and the fall. So the rise,
yeah.
the altitude from the rise to the fall is much bigger than when you do it modern anyway.
Yes. No, I think that's absolutely right. And of course, it is the period in which the piece was written. It was composed between 1925 and 1935. When Beck died, but there's some offstage band music in the end of the first act, for instance, which is playing these tangos and English waltzes and things in this very sort of jazz-oriented idiom, which again fits so wonderfully with this period between the wars. I mean, it's kind of flapper music, you know. Expect them to all start dancing the Charleston or something. And so the period obviously is supposed to be somewhat earlier, because what's Jack the Ripper doing in the 1930s? But it comes to life in a way, I think, that's absolutely right. It sort of gels with the music. In fact, because I remember when Paul and I first started to talk about it, I said to him, look, I want this to be, you know, I don't want this to be in some weird kind of contemporary situation, and he said, "When do you think we should do it?" I said, "The 20s or the 30s," and it often works, you know. That I mean, for instance, people have done very successful Verdi productions that are either set in the period that the story is set in, or else set in the period of Verdi's life, and it seems to work very well. And Berg somehow lived this rather slightly decadent world in Vienna. He was a very elegant man, had some romantic sexual relations, liaisons of his own, curiously enough, one of which was particularly important to the composition of this piece, but we're not going to go into that. That's another 2 hours we have to talk about it.
It's talk for years, really.
Yeah. Yeah. So this, I think, it works brilliantly, absolutely. And the set is very attractive. The other thing, especially the first act, is acoustically very good because it's an enclosed box, so that the voices are really beautifully sent out into the audience.
There is a film sequence that in this opera, and Berg wrote music specifically to accompany it. So, Marlis, can you talk about the experience that you had making the film? And in all of these other Lulu productions, were you part of a film in each one?
No, for me, it was actually the first time that I did this film. And it was a major experience, really. I've never did a film before, and I felt like a Broadway star. Really. You know, they dressed me up really like Louise Brooks.
Yeah, Louise Brooks in Pandora's Box, which I hope all of you will go out and rent before you see Lulu. It's another good way to prepare. Silent film from, I think, 1928, thereabouts. 29, thank you. So you had the costume and the makeup.
Perhaps,
and everything.
Yeah, the makeup and the beautiful dress, and then we were shooting the different takes, which you will see in a collection of, like, is it 3 minutes?
About that,
about,
yes.
About three minutes. And it took us 2 days to do that film.
It
was really quick. I think it can be longer. But it was amazing. And what is amazing also is that every shot is done in the Lyric Opera, in some spot, somewhere in the building. That's fascinating. Yeah. I didn't know what ugly places there are.
I want to pause just to tell you that now is the time to pass your cards to your right, and my colleagues will come down the aisle to pick up the cards while we continue our discussion. Andrew, what is the function of the film sequence? Why is it there?
Well, it tells the story, basically. It's a handy way of getting some of the facts of what's happened, you know, after Lulu's arrest in the middle of the second act. And I must say, one of the things that's good about this film is it's very clear. And basically what happens is she's arrested, she's taken and tried, condemned, goes to prison, and then a process which is too complicated to talk about here, but she catches cholera, she goes into hospital, Countess Geschwitz, who is her lesbian lover, admirer, shall we say, goes and changes places with her in the hospital, so that's how she escapes. And all this is shown in the film, in a remarkable brevity, but great clarity, I have to say. The only time I've done it before on stage, of course, was the Glyndebourne, and we had a film then, I think, which is good, but I think this one's better, actually.
I wanted to go back to the music for a second, because Marlis, I just wanted to ask you, is it possible to sing the whole role all the way through with beauty of sound, or do you think that there are moments when beauty isn't really what the piece needs?
I think there are moments you don't need to sing beautiful. I think actually it's really difficult to sing the whole thing beautifully, but I think he has some purposes of Berg really were that you express what you feel. And there are some moments when I really just... Yeah.
No, she never does that.
I remember. Yeah, I do this when I sing... Wenn ihr die Treppen hinunterleuchtet.
Oh.
That's my favorite place.
Well, she has... She has to do it then because the orchestra's loud.
Remind me where that occurs in the opera. So we'll all know to be waiting for it.
That's in the discussion with the... In the third act, with the
Marquis.
Yeah, with the Marquis, exactly.
Oh, no. You're right, it's the athlete. Yes.
We should all be waiting for that line. I love it. Now, Andrew, does the same thing apply to the orchestra? I mean, are there moments in the drama where if people play particularly mellifluously, that's not really doing the job?
Well, yes, but you could say that about Beethoven, couldn't you? You don't play Beethoven mellifluously all the time. Yes, but the thing is what I try to do with this piece is absolutely make the most of the lyrical moments and the elegant moments I mean, there's a lot of... Berg was a very elegant man. And I mean, the end of the first act, where Schön is having a letter dictated to him by Lulu, is marked to be played like a gavotte. Sehr geehrtes Fräulein. I'm sorry, it was a little too fast the other day. And then, of course, I wanted to kill myself because no. And then, of course, once you've set a tempo, anyway, that's another thing. So it'll be a little slow. But it has because it has a very kind of poised sense to it. Ra di di da rum bum 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 ba da da. And she's sort of, and again, the production is marvelous. She's sort of over him, standing on the desk part of the time, and on the sort of dressing table, and he's sitting there writing this letter at her dictation. And it because the music has such elegance, there's a kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of cruelty about it in a way, that actually, because it's being done in such, I mean, she's not standing over him and beating him. She's doing it by the force of her will and the force of the fascination that he has for her that is inescapable.
Yes, and I think, of course, we were discussing about Lulu a lot. Of course, she has this erotic fascination and this attraction, the sexual attraction to men, very much. And she knows exactly how to use it with every man in the different way. That's what she has learned. She has grown up like that and she uses it. But I never think that she does this on a bad purpose.
No, no.
Yeah.
No,
it's just her own nature, in a way.
That's why I said that it, at the core of her somewhere there's an innocence that is why I think when we reach the end of the opera and she comes to her tragic end, we are all so affected by this. I mean, you know, she's... and you look at what she's done in the course of the opera and think, but this is not a really nice person, you know? But there is something about her that is so irresistible that the fact that she's killed in the end this horrible way becomes unbearable, I think. For me, at any rate. So in the answer to your question, I mean, there are some horrific moments, like the moment when she's killed by Jack the Ripper. There's this ghastly chord that consists of all 12 notes of the chromatic scale at once. But, well, no, I won't go into all that, but it's the way this chord works, that it's brutal, but it's somehow not, you know, it's brutal, but it's not ugly.
It's not noise.
No, it's just, yeah. It's not noise. And that's the amazing thing about this piece. And there's a great deal of delicacy in the orchestra as well. I mean, there are some big moments. But for the most part, if you play, particularly the more the opera goes through, I think at the very beginning, the first scenes are some of the most difficult musically to balance, and the music is a bit fidgety. That's because the situation is fidgety. But as the piece progresses, there are more long stretches of lyrical music, and the orchestration is absolutely sensuous and quite beautiful. Interesting, a lot of use of the piano and of the saxophone. And the saxophone gives the this characteristic sound, which has this slightly, it's erotic, it's slightly sleazy at times, you might say, but the use of that instrument, and also the vibraphone, it gives this kind of glow to the music that's very characteristic of
a lot of colours in the orchestra.
We've said a bit about her character, but there's one thing, Marlis, that always sort of perplexes me because I don't know if I can believe it or not, and I'm wondering if it's important to you that we do believe it, and that is when, after she kills Schön, immediately after she kills Schön, she says, "But he's the only man I've ever loved." And so do you believe in her at that moment? Does she believe it herself? When she says that.
I really think that she loves him very much and he's the only one she has really deep feelings for. Of course, I mean, this is not a... She's not a healthy woman or a normally raised girl. She has experiences and she brought all these experiences to this moment of her life when she loves this man, which is, for her, at the same time, the lover and the father. or the father figure in a way. Somebody that cares, takes her, holds her. And I think this is a very, very deep love of hers. And I think all the moments, all the schön motifs that come throughout the whole piece, I think it's every time the need of love she has constantly in this piece, and even more when we go to the end and she loses one lover after the other, and at the end Alva is murdered also. So it's just Schigolch remaining, and he says this wonderful sentence: "If you look for me, I'm down in the restaurant, I'm down in the bar,
in the pub." Yeah,
yeah. So he's the only one who goes through the whole piece without dying. Yes, and she's very lonely at the end, and I think this is also the reason why, with Jack the Ripper, it's not important anymore for her to get money for what she does. She just needs a hug.
Yeah,
and she's, I think, open to give everything, her last shirt, for this. It's a very sad end. But I think this need of love is already in the beginning of the piece, you know. I think it's like a red line in her as a person, as a character.
And you were talking earlier about the Lied der Lulu, Lulu's song, aria, which happens just before she shoots Dr. Schön. And basically she says, well, it's this, you know, men have needed me and well, I...
Well, she says, I gave you my youth, and it was a fair exchange. But what did he give her? Oh, he married her, and she gave him her youth as in fair exchange, and then the rest of it is... Oh, it's the last two lines are so important. Can you describe those last two lines of the Lied where she says, men have never taken me for anything other than what I am? You know, this.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Nobody has taken me for what he... Oh, the translation.
I never tried to be anything other than what the man wanted me to be. Is that right?
Not exactly.
No. Not exactly.
No.
What is in German?
Man hat mich nie für etwas anderes genommen, als ich bin.
I have never in the world tried to be anything...
other than I am.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So, but I think she finds this out in this moment. I think she has never thought about this sentence before.
Right.
In this particular moment of pressure, she has the
revolver.
The revolver in her hands.
And she's pointing it at him.
Pointing at him. And then this just comes out of her. And I think when she did the last sentence, this one, she's just standing there and thinking, what did I say? What did I just say? I think she surprised herself about what she said there. And this is the moment when it starts to get down again.
Yes.
Becoming aware of everything in her life, and then...
Makes life more difficult when you understand.
Absolutely.
It. And there's another, in Act 3, Scene 1, in the Paris scene, when she's having this big argument with this pimp who's trying to sell her to a brothel in Cairo. There is actually a reprise of musically of the Lied from the second act, where the melodic line is played by the flute, over which Lulu has another thing. But it's a very similar opening of herself when she talks about how she felt when she was in prison and realized different things about herself. So, and there are these constant kind of correspondences in the piece which make it, again, on a psychological level, even if you're not aware of it, and of course you won't be the first time, but somehow this piece it rewards study in a way unlike any opera that I know, because you're constantly, and I'm, you know, off 40 years and more after I started loving and studying this piece, I'm still finding out new things about it.
That's what I say. Every new production brings new experiences. It's never what you have done before.
I've found with at least two pieces that I could think of. One was Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth and Mtsensk, and another was actually Wozzeck, that it took me perhaps 7 complete, you know, times of going through the entire piece before I said, I think I get it now. You know? So I wanted to tell all of you that I hope you will come back and see Lulu a second time, because I don't know that anyone could possibly take in everything that is in this piece at one go. There's so much that it has to communicate. Now, yes.
Yes, but on the other hand, don't go thinking, oh, Lord, I'm not going to understand this at all, because actually you do. You get it.
Oh,
absolutely.
You get it. It's very clear. The story is clear. The music is clear.
It is
so rich that it really does repay many hearings and viewings.
I'm wondering, living with this piece for weeks at a time, both of you, how do you survive physically and emotionally, during the rehearsals and performances? I mean, do you have a particular routine, like when you go home to unwind from Lulu and restore your energies? What do you, Marlis, what do you do after a Lulu performance?
You know, what I found out now with the dress rehearsal is new for me. When I did it like 7 years ago or 8 years ago, it was hard for me to make all the three acts with my energy. Now, it's easy. It's not easy, but I make it easier than I did before. Some other things have changed also, so it's really... And also the piece changes, I think, for each of us who look at it. If you watch it in 2 years, you have a different approach to it. If you see another direction, another regie, it's a constant rebuilding moment, yeah, a big piece of change. So, but after the performance, I'm really so excited that I need maybe 3 hours to calm down. So it's good to be out with some friends or with the cast and have a beer and chat about the piece and how it's gone and how bad the conductor was that evening.
Andrew, do you go out and have a beer too after Lulu?
No, I usually go home and have a Negroni, but
that's also
no,
nice.
But this is a piece more than any other piece I ever conduct, with the possible exception of the Ninth Symphony of Mahler. This is a piece that takes me over in a way. You should ask Jana about this. She always says to people, I try and stay away from him when he's conducting Lulu. but it inhabits, I mean, it takes my soul over in a way that I think is true of very few other pieces.
I wanted to ask both of you about previous productions, just to get an idea of what other views of this piece have worked. For example, Marlis, you just did it in Athens. What was that like? I mean, we have photos of it, which are absolutely spectacular, which we've put into our brochure. Was it anything like this?
Oh no, not at all. Completely different. More nowadays.
Yes.
And more, I wouldn't say casual, but yeah, not in a special period, yeah. But also very great. What I liked about the Athens one very much is that the designer, Gottfried Pilz at that time, he decided to really present a new girl with each lover. So I had like 10 wigs and 15 costumes. So you see women coming out the door and saying, who is she? It's Lulu. Yeah. And half an hour later, another moment, new wig, new... Huh? It's really... She changes. She's like a chameleon.
Chameleon,
in a way, adapts exactly to the situation. This is what I found very fascinating in Athens. Huh? And you have different aspects in different regies that are kind of revealing and bringing out a new color in that whole path.
Andrew, you did it at Glyndebourne, and was that anything like what we do?
No. It was sort of contemporary, and it was interesting. The set and we did it in Glyndebourne when the new opera house there was relatively new, and there's a lot of brickwork in the outside of the house, and it was, that's what the set looked inside. It looked like all the brickwork, which is, and it was, it was a single set for the whole piece, which worked well for some scenes and not so well for others. But it was very powerful. I mean, in terms of the personal direction of and the characterization of the act, the actor singers, it was very good. And Wolfgang Schörner, actually, I've done the three times I've done it have all been with Wolfgang Schörner, who sings the role of Dr. Schörner, who is really remarkable and has an intensity and you feel this man is about to explode most of the time, you know, this character, and which is why they're so right that Jack the Ripper is the reincarnation, as it were, of Schoen. Because it's like all this rage that you've seen in him and this frustration comes out as a mass murderer. But, but there, as Marley says, there are so many ways of interpreting this piece, as there are, of course, all the great works.
Marlis, here's an interesting question. Are there moments you feel Lulu is not innocent or amoral, but intentionally cruel? For instance, when she reminds Alva, as he's making love to her, that they're on the sofa on which his father bled to death.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Also, this moment when she says, "Ich habe deine Mutter vergiftet, I poisoned your mother." In the intimate moment, she says that, yeah, this is kind of a very crazy little switch she has.
Yes. And it's also, I mean, that's, when I talked about the sort of cynical, brittle kind of nature of the plays. But somehow, again, with the music, it has a slightly... a different kind of feel. I mean, it's hard to describe, but yes, I mean, and there is a lot of humour, and particularly black humour in the piece. That's something else we haven't talked about. There are some hilarious moments.
Yeah, I just have the... I think she's testing out sometimes, because she is in a big fear of losing love, so she makes sure that the person who she wants at that moment doesn't let her fall, let her go. And I think in these very intimate moments with Alva, when she says, "Is das noch der, is that the sofa where your daddy bled out?" I think she has the moments of truth always in these very crucial
intense moments.
Yeah. When she is about to gain somebody's love, she's just testing him if he can bear that, if he's able to carry her, really. I think this is something very deep inside someone. Mm-hmm. You know, when you open up for something, better close fast in order not to get hurt.
Yes.
That's and that exactly brings out some special masks to wear. Yeah.
Andrew, here's a question that's very important, actually. The third act, which we haven't talked about very much, was completed after Berg's death. Is it of equal musical and dramatic quality as the first two?
Yeah. The short answer to that is yes. Now, Berg had composed the whole thing with the exception of a very few bars in Act 2, Scene 1. He'd orchestrated about a third of the act. And his short score, as we call it, actually had various indications of instrumentation in it as well. It was orchestrated by an Austrian composer called Cherha, and interestingly enough, after it first appeared, then there were some revisions were made, and when people first heard the opening of the scene of the third act, they said, "But this music is completely different," which it is, but it's Berg, and actually we hear this music, a foretaste of it, right at the beginning of the prologue, and it's very artificial. It's a kind of musical carousel, kind of what we call in England a roundabout. It's like that, you know, carousel music that you see at a fair or in a circus. I mean, it's got this sort of glittering artificiality, almost surreal quality to it. And the whole scene is played out that way, which is completely new for the piece. So I think a lot of people who have known the two-act version for so long had trouble with this because it seemed to grate on them.
And but they thought it's not deliberate. Berg. Huh? I think they thought it's not Berg because it's so different.
Yeah.
But I think he did that on purpose in order to show... It's all about money in this thing.
Yeah.
And she's in Paris now with Alva, and it's a very superficial life
yes.
there. It's just money and spending and good dresses and lipsticks and, you know, and I think Berg really intended that.
Yes, and the whole thing is on the edge, you know, because she's constantly fighting to stop herself either being arrested or being sold to a brothel in Cairo. So
that's what happens underneath.
Yes.
The threats of the people like Marquis and...
The athlete.
This is really like very, very bad. And on the other hand, it's just a little... That's what it is.
Now, Marlis, have you done a production without Act 3?
Oh, yeah, I did.
And was it satisfying or not so satisfying? Or?
I'm always sad when I do it without. I mean, there's this version where they do the Lulu variations. And, I mean, Athens, for example, they did the Lulu variations and they made the kind of a pantomime of Paris and London act. And this was... It happens in 20 minutes, I think.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, what was always done before was the variations is the interlude in the middle of the third act. And then Berg, then the final adagio, which is the last 10 minutes of the piece and ends up with Countess Gesvitz saying... I will stay with you forever as she is dying. This was orchestrated and presented by Berg for something which he called the Lulu Suite or Lulu Symphony, which was actually premiered before Lulu was, obviously, because he didn't finish Lulu. And he wanted to present some of the music to the public so they wouldn't completely forget about him. And so this is complete, and that's what's often done in the last two sections of the Lulu Symphony or Suite.
Yeah, exactly.
But and the music, of course, is beautiful, but it's not...
It's not the full thing.
Right.
I think for Lulu, playing Lulu, it's very important to have the third act in order to get the London bit right. Because I think this is really the last edge of life. And it's important to see how she comes to that and all this threat in the third act, in this high society, superficial things, and all these bad people threatening her.
And also for Berg, you know, Berg... So much of his music is symmetry is very important, and just on a dramatic scale, you have, as it were, Lulu's ascent. She becomes more and more successful in terms of, and she marries Schoen, she lives in this big house, and then she shoots him, and then from the middle of the second act, there's her gradual decline. And interestingly enough, the film interlude, which comes bang in the middle of the opera, in the middle of the second act, is musically a palindrome, which is to say it runs one way and then it runs backwards. And you can hear this very clearly, particularly at the moment in the middle, where everything is very fast and furious, and then it gradually slows down and there's a sort of static chord with piano and vibraphone on top. And then you hear this chord again, and you can hear it running backwards. It's very clear. I mean, you know, you can't memorize the whole thing and say, "Oh yes, I remember that bit going the other way around." But it is a sort of symbol that now everything that's going up is going to be going down. And so, without the third act, there is no sense of proportion about the whole piece. Anyway,
I want to urge all of you to purchase your Lulu tickets now if you haven't done so already. I think it's going to be a triumph that we'll all be very, very proud of and excited about. Thank you very much, Sir Andrew Davis and Marlis Paterson.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.